Well, go ahead and have your Bibles open to John 4 this evening. We are going to be looking in John chapter 4 and a little bit of the history behind this story. The woman at the well is typically what we would title this. And let's read a few verses as we get started here in John chapter 4 by way of introduction. When therefore, in verse 1, the Lord knew that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself was not baptizing, but his disciples were, he left Judea and departed again into Galilee. And he had to pass through Samaria. So he came to a city of Samaria called Sychar, near the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. And Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, was sitting thus by the well. And it was about the sixth hour. In verse 7, there came a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. Now in verse 9, the Samaritan woman therefore said to him, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask me for a drink, since I am a Samaritan woman? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." And in verse 10, Jesus answered and said to her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." Now, we are going to talk about the woman at the well later on in this lesson. But this is going to be kind of a different way to look at this story. Rather than simply looking at it verse by verse and drawing applications from what is there on the page, I want to look at some of the history behind this area, because I believe there is a reason why Jesus stopped in this place when he did and talked to who he did. The who, the where, and the why are all very valuable. And unless you know anything about this region, Sychar and Jacob's Well, and some of the areas surrounding it, like the city of Shechem, you might not get exactly what it is that Jesus is trying to convey by talking to her in this conversation. And again, we will look a little bit more at the story of the woman at the well in just a few moments here. Here's a photograph, if you'd like to note, the area around ancient Sychar. Sychar is not a city anymore, at least as we would define a city. The city that you see here between the two mountains is actually ancient Neapolis. And Neapolis, is the name has been sort of changed a bit into Arabic Nablus. And Nablus is a modern-day city of around 100,000 people. You notice that on either side of the city of Nablus are two prominent features. On the right side, or the north, is Mount Ebal. On the left side of the south is Mount Gerizim. Notice also near the top, near the middle of Mount Gerizim, there's a very small building there. That small building is the location of where the Samaritans would have built for themselves in the 5th century BC a temple that would have rivaled the temple in Jerusalem. That building there on the top of the mountain happens to be a shrine for a little-known Arab sheikh. Including on that mountain, there's a Byzantine, the ruins at least of a Byzantine chapel. This city, Nablus, is actually the location of ancient Shechem. And Shechem is a very interesting city, very prominently featured in the Old Testament. It's actually mentioned 60 times in the Old Testament. And we're going to look a little bit at Shechem here in this lesson. This is Jacob's Well as it is today. You think, well, that's probably not exactly what it would have looked like when Jesus and the woman at the well would have participated in this conversation in John 4. But I will say that this well is, according to most historians, the best attested historical site from the New Testament. So even though this isn't exactly what the well would have looked like, this is actually about 15 feet below street level. You have to go down a set of stairs underneath a modern-day chapel to get to this well. But this, at least if you take archaeology and history with any value, this is, without almost any doubt, the well that Jesus would have sat at with this woman, this Samaritan woman, to have this conversation. Just happens to be 15 feet below street level underneath a cathedral. I was thinking it's interesting when you look at the Bible and you realize something very distinctive about the Bible, that this is not Middle Earth. This is not the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. These are not made-up lands, made-up territories. These are not fake cities. This is not fiction. When you read in the Bible, and most unbelievers believe and admit this, You might not agree with what's in the Bible, but you must acknowledge that what is in the Bible takes place in real locations in a real time period that is within definable history. And I just think it's so interesting that you can go to the Middle East now and you can actually stand in these places. You can take water. This well, Jacob's well, is about, I believe it's 155 feet deep. You can actually take water from the same well that Jesus would have drawn water from. And I think it makes the story very real. Now, again, this is a picture of Nablus right here, or Neapolis, as it would have been known in the first century. And in the foreground, these ruins are the ruins of ancient Shechem, which is, again, a city mentioned 60 times in the Old Testament. The mountain up there, like we've already mentioned, is Mount Gerizim, at the top of which the Samaritans would have built their own temple to God. The significance of Shechem goes beyond just a little bit of history and some archaeology, though. Although Shechem had been destroyed by the Jewish leader John Hyrcanus in 107 BC, the surrounding villages, including Sychar from John 4, did have a small population of Samaritans living there. Shechem itself was one of the most significant locations in the Old Testament. And I believe that it is no accident or coincidence that Jesus stops here on his way back to Galilee. Somebody might contend that he had to stop there because that's the main highway that leads from the south to the north, and I guess that's true. If you're taking the main highway and this happens to be a good pit stop, that would explain a little bit of it. But something I've noticed about Jesus in my time studying his life, there's very little that he did was coincidence. Very little that he did in his life was just accident. I think if you study some of the history behind his actions, where he did something, you realize that he was very purposeful, very intentional in the things that he did. And I do believe, like I said, there is a reason why Jesus stops in Sychar and talks to a woman about living water, a Samaritan woman of all people. But that's not it. Let's look a little bit further at some of the history of Shechem. And again, modern-day Nablus sits on top of Shechem as it would have been. And Shechem and Sychar are not the same city. Some people think that Sychar is a corruption of the Hebrew name Shechem, but most historians believe that it's not. They believe they're two distinctive villages that just happen to be very close to each other and shared Jacob's well with one another. But nevertheless, they are in the same general region. In Genesis chapter 12, verses 6 through 8, very notable point in Shechem's history, who happens to be there in Shechem and receives a message from God? It is in Shechem that Abraham is given the promise by God that all the earth shall be blessed through his seed. Let's keep that in our minds. In Genesis chapter 33, all the way into Genesis chapter 34, we find Jacob settling here in Shechem. What happens in Shechem, of course, is an interesting piece of Israelite history. While he's there, in fact, let's go ahead and turn to chapter 34 and notice something here. While he's there, he actually has a bit of a conflict with the Shechemites through two of his sons. And in Genesis chapter 34, Jacob and his family have settled here in Shechem. And notice in verse 1, "Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he took her and lay with her by force. And he was deeply attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. And he loved the girl, and he spoke tenderly to her." It's always nice, after the fact, to speak nice and tenderly to somebody. Not really. That would not be a suggested 21st century move to make. Verse 4. "So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, 'Get me this young girl for a wife.' Now Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter, but his sons were with his livestock in the field. So Jacob kept silent until they came in. And in verse 6, Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. Now the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved, and they were angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not to be done. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, 'The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage and intermarry with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters for yourselves. Thus you shall live with us. The land shall be open before you. Live and trade in it and acquire property in it.' And it is at this point that two of Jacob's sons trick the Shechemites into getting circumcised." There is something, using your imagination, of course, that happens to an adult man when he's circumcised, it essentially makes him useless for combat. When all the men of the city of Shechem have gotten themselves circumcised in order to at least give the gesture of peace with the Israelites, the children of Jacob, two of the sons of Jacob go into the city and slaughter every single male from Shechem. Thus, I believe that Shechem takes on its first bit of symbolism. It is the city of pretense. It is the place where promises are made and not kept. It is the place where covenants are made between men, and one side of that covenant does not keep its vows. You remember again in Genesis chapter 12 that this is also the same city where Abraham was promised by God that all the world would be blessed through his seed. A covenant on God's part. Please keep all these things in mind, this idea of covenants and promises, that God offers things, promises things, and man repeatedly breaks his own vows. Shechem was a city of refuge. When we move on, when the Israelites come to take the land of Canaan for themselves as their own land, it becomes a city of refuge. There were several cities that were set aside that if you were ever accused of manslaughter, not intentional murder, but manslaughter, you could go to one of these cities of refuge and you'd be safe from any kind of vengeance from the person's family who had been killed by you accidentally, until the law could piece through the system and the judge could come up with an answer. You could go to this city of refuge and be safe from any kind of revenge. And Shechem was one of those cities. So again, this is a place where covenants are made, where promises are made that if you come to Shechem, you're safe. It's also a place of blessing. Shechem was set aside for the Kohathites, who were Levites, as a place where Levites could live and exist. In Joshua 24, verse 32, Joseph's remains are buried in Shechem. This was a promise that he had his children and grandchildren make. When Joseph was dying, he asked that when you go and take possession of the land that God has promised to you, do one thing for me. Take my bones out of Egypt with you and bury them in that plot of land that my father Jacob purchased. Of course, this is all talked about in John chapter 4. In Joshua chapter 8, let's go to Joshua 8 and notice a couple things here. And in chapter 24, twice the Israelites are ordered to go to Shechem and renew their commitment to God. Here's an interesting photograph for you to consider. As we read in Joshua chapter 8, beginning in verse 30. One half of the people of Israel is asked to be on one side of the valley. Again, on the left side of the south side is Mount Gerizim. On the right or the north side is Mount Ebal. Half the assembly of Israelites were on the face of Gerizim. Half the others were on the face of Ebal. And in Joshua chapter 8 and in verse 30, then Joshua built an altar to the Lord, the God of Israel, on Mount Ebal, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded the sons of Israel back in Deuteronomy chapter 27, as it is written in the book of the law of Moses, an altar of uncut stones on which no man had wielded an iron tool. And they offered burnt offerings unto the Lord and sacrificed peace offerings. And he wrote on the stones a copy of the law of Moses. Again, just like it said in Deuteronomy chapter 27, which he had written in the presence of the sons of Israel. And all Israel with their elders and officers, their judges, were standing on both sides of the ark before the Levitical priests who carried the ark of the covenant of the Lord, the stranger as well as the native. Half of them stood in front of Mount Gerizim, and half of them stood in front of Mount Ebal, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had given commandment. Then afterward, in verse 34, he read all the words of the law, the blessing and the curse, according to all that is written in the book of the law. There was not a word of all that Moses had commanded, which Joshua did not read before all the assembly of Israel, with the women and the little ones and the strangers even who were living among them. How cool would that scene have been? It is tradition, actually, that's been passed down, that this scene actually involved a call and response from one mountain to the other. Half of these Israelites, on Mount Ebal specifically, would call out the curses from the law. The other half of the Israelites from Mount Gerizim would call out the blessings from the law. It is said even today that you can hear quite clearly from the top of the mountain down into the town below. One writer even said that as he was on the top of Mount Gerizim, he could hear small children playing in a schoolyard in the middle of that town that you see in this photograph. From the top of that hill, he could hear children playing in a schoolyard. So imagine what it would be like to have thousands, even tens of thousands of Israelites gathered on either side of this valley, crying, singing out to each other the scriptures, the blessings and the curses presented in the book of Deuteronomy. This is the place of blessing and cursing. This is the place of covenants made by God, covenants broken by man. But that's not the end. A couple more things happen in Shechem that we need to talk about before we go back to John 4. Judges 9. You remember Abimelech, don't you? The heinous, obscene first king of Israel, so to speak. Abimelech is one of the sons of Gideon. He shows up here in Judges chapter 9 with the people of Shechem and suggests that he would be a very suitable king for all of them. So the Shechemites gladly install him as king and later regret it. After a couple of years, they realize that Abimelech is not exactly the man that they thought he was, not exactly the king that they wished he would be. In the process of things, the city of Shechem is actually destroyed by Abimelech. He burns the city to the ground. All the people had gathered in the tower in the center of the city, and he gets all of his men and puts lumber and wood at the bottom of it, and he basically burns all the men of the city to the ground in their own tower. Again, covenants made, covenants broken, a place of blessing, but also a place of curses. 1 Kings chapter 12 and 2 Chronicles 10. Shechem is the location of Rehoboam's quote-unquote coronation as king. Now, it would have been a convenient location. It was near the middle between Jerusalem and the northern tribes. So it would have been convenient for Rehoboam to go there as a gesture almost to the northern tribes to say, we're unified, we're the same people. I'm coming to your place, to Shechem, to become king over the united tribes of Israel. What else happens in Shechem, though? Rehoboam doesn't listen to the guidance of the people. They tell him to lower the taxes, to lift the burden that his father Solomon put upon them. He even listens to his advisors who say, you've got to listen to the people. You must lower the taxes, release them, lift the burden. Who does he listen to, though? His own cronies and contemporaries. Thus, Shechem becomes not the place where Rehoboam, in the line of David, becomes king over a unified Israel. Shechem actually becomes the place of division. Shechem is the place where Rehoboam has to run away from because he's so terrified of what Jeroboam and the northern tribes could do to him. And again, I think we're seeing this same pattern. Shechem is the place of blessings and curses, of covenants made, and of covenants broken. In 2 Kings chapter 17 and verse 24, we find that after Israel, the northern tribes, had fallen to Assyria, the Assyrians took as many of these Israelites from their homeland captive. They took them with them back to Assyria and would have assimilated them into other cultures in other parts of the world. And in the vacancy left then in the northern tribes, the Assyrians brought foreigners. And they took all these foreigners, slaves in their own right, and placed them in the land of Israel to serve the Assyrians. Now all of these foreigners here in 2 Kings chapter 17 are getting used to their new home. They've moved into homes, they've built cities, they've gotten used to things. And what starts happening in the land? Lions! Yeah, lions show up and lions start killing them. And they find out, well, the lions are killing us because we're not serving the God of this land. So some Israelites then, some folks from the southern tribes of Judah, priests in fact, come to Shechem and the northern tribes. And they teach these foreigners the ways of the Lord. They teach them about Jehovah and teach them the law. Unfortunately, by the end of 2 Kings 17, what you find out is that these foreigners who learned about Jehovah were more than happy to integrate him into their own religious customs. The only result was syncretism between Jehovah God and the other foreign gods and other kinds of idols. So that is sort of where we end up here. In Ezra 4, the Samaritans then, descendants of these people placed there by Assyria, who know a little bit about Jehovah, who worship him a little bit as part of their pantheon of idols, the Samaritans show up in Ezra chapter 4, thinking that the Israelites in Jerusalem would offer them the hand of fellowship. When the folks in Jerusalem are going to rebuild the temple, the Samaritans figure, well, hey, we've been worshiping their God for like several hundred years now. Maybe we can show up in Jerusalem and these Israelites, these Hebrews, will become our friends. Maybe we can even help them build their temple. So the Samaritans, I believe with the best of intentions, show up in Jerusalem and say, we'd like to help build the temple with you because we worship your God. We learned about him a long time ago. Yeah, we're the same people. We worship your God. Of course, what do the folks in Jerusalem think about that? They want to know part of it. They're not going to allow any Samaritans to help build their temple. And this then becomes the first of many, many, many insults between the Hebrews and the Samaritans. Which is why in John 4, the woman at the well is so surprised. She says, I can't believe that you, being a Jew, would want to talk to me, being a Samaritan woman. And in parentheses it says, the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. This is why. The Jews considered the Samaritans to be some kind of a heinous religious half-breed. They knew a little bit about Jehovah. They understood a little bit of the law. But they didn't know enough. They were not ethnically Jewish. They'd not purified themselves from the pagan customs of their past. And really all they had done was synthesize or syncretize somewhat Jehovah God with their own pagan customs. The Jews wanted to have nothing to do with them. They were, in a sense, religious mutants that didn't have a place with any well-meaning Jew. When Jesus is talking to the woman at the well in John 4, going back to our original text, he says, if you knew who I was, if you knew anything about who I was, when I offered you water, you would have taken it. And you would have had living water. You would never thirst again. I like this term, living water. The background provides an explanation, actually. Samaritan, well, we've got that part already, excuse me. Living water was generally understood to mean water that was flowing rather than water that was in a cistern or water that was stagnant. And the water that came from Jacob's well was part of an underground aquifer. So it was considered living, moving water. Now, he uses a term that she would have understood. It was a commonplace term. That's living water versus stagnant water. But he takes this common household term of living water and he stretches it beyond its common meaning. Go back to John 4 and let's read a little bit further on our story now that you've got some more of the background. She says in verse 11, Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is very deep. Again, it would have been perhaps 32 to 55 meters deep. Where then do you get this living water? Again, she's not saying living water like it's uncommon. She thinks he's talking about living water as in moving water, fresh water from underground. She says, where do you get this living water? Verse 12, You are not greater than our father Jacob, are you, who gave us the well and drank of it himself and his sons and his cattle? I think it's interesting that the Samaritans believed that their heritage went all the way back to Jacob. Ethnically, that's ridiculous. They didn't go all the way back to Jacob, but they assumed Jacob as their heritage. They lived in Jacob's land. They drank from Jacob's well. They lived on Jacob's own property, his possession. Some of Jacob's descendants were buried right there. There were tombs of Jacob's family. They assumed Jacob as their own heritage. But Jesus answers in verse 13, Everyone who drinks of this water shall thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him shall become in him a well of water springing up to eternal life. Now the woman's not a dullard. Kind of like how we studied a few weeks ago in the previous chapter. You remember in chapter 3 when we talked about Nicodemus and how the assumption is always that Nicodemus is kind of a dummy. Like, hey, don't you get it? Jesus is talking about baptism there. Now, it's not that Nicodemus is a dullard, and it's not that the woman at the well was a dullard either. She simply saw things from a carnal perspective. It's all that she saw. When she heard living water, she thought, oh, fresh, potable, moving water. And that's what she saw, because she lives in a carnal world. It's all her mind thinks about. And we're not really so different, are we? We're really not so different. I think about some of the times that we read about the same way that we can be carnally focused, worldly focused. In 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 11, the writer of 1 Corinthians notes the way that the carnal man or the natural man simply does not have the ability or the perspective to understand spiritual things. For who among men, he says, knows the thoughts of man except the spirit of man, which is in him? Even so, the thoughts of God no one knows except the spirit of God. Now we have received, he says, not the spirit of the world, the carnal spirit, the fleshly spirit, but the spirit who is from God, that we might know the things freely given to us by God, which things we also speak, not in words taught by human wisdom, but in those taught by the Spirit, combining spiritual thoughts with spiritual words. But he says in verse 14 of 1 Corinthians 2, the natural man, the word natural there means earthly, carnal. The natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they're foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them because they are spiritually appraised. So I don't blame the woman for not understanding what Jesus is talking about. This is a woman who's going about her business. She's down there trying to fetch water because she needs water. She's thirsty, and actual, physical, literal water is the only thing that's going to satiate or satisfy that thirst. We're all a lot like her. But Jesus pushes her to stretch her thinking a little bit. Consider Isaiah chapter 41 and verse 17. In Isaiah 41 and verse 17, look what it says here in the Scriptures. The afflicted and needy are seeking water, but there is none. And you can fill yourself with physical water all day long, and it will never fill that part of you that is sick and afflicted and needy. They seek water all day long. That's what they're looking for. And the woman at the well was looking for water. Now maybe she was looking for physical water, but you find out from later in the conversation there was definitely something about her. She was looking for something more. Their tongue is parched with thirst, he says, but I, the Lord, will answer them myself. As the God of Israel, I will not forsake them. I will open rivers on the bare heights and springs in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land fountains of water. I think Jesus had Isaiah 41 in mind when he was telling the woman at the well that you can have a soul where water is springing forth, where not only are you satisfied, but your own soul becomes a well, a spring to satisfy others around you. But that's not all. He spoke of food in John chapter 6 as well. Repeatedly in John chapter 6, when the people came to him seeking more food, like he'd already given them previously, he repeatedly tells them in this chapter, don't seek the food that never satisfies. Don't seek the food that only goes into your stomach and eventually is eliminated. Seek something more. He ends there in chapter 6, verse 63, by saying, the flesh profits nothing. It's the Spirit that gives. Verse 15 of John 4. Now the woman said to him, sir, give me the water, so that I will not be thirsty, nor come all the way here to draw. I don't know if she's still not catching on yet about the spiritual application, but I like that she keeps the conversation going. In verse 16, and he said to her, go, call your husband and come here. Now the woman said, I have no husband. And Jesus said to her, you have well said, I have no husband. For you actually have had five husbands, and the one who you have now is not really your husband. This you have said truly. I like in verse 19. The woman says, sir, I perceive that you're a prophet. You think? Yeah. You think? I like this idea of I have no husband. When we look at the history of Shechem, and this is why I spent all that time, and I'm sorry that we're going a little bit over here. This is why I spent all that time in the beginning of the lesson looking at the history of Shechem, because Shechem's history is littered with broken promises, with curses, with bad memories. This should have been the most promising city in all of Israel. This was where Abraham received the blessing and the promise. This is where Jacob came. This is Joseph's tomb. This is Jacob's well. This is the place where kings are coronated. I mean, this should have been the most optimistic, happy, prosperous, spiritual city in all of Israel. But when you read Shechem's history, it's nothing but full of Abimelechs and Rehoboams. It is the city of promises made by God and promises broken by man. And finally, the Samaritans build a temple on top of Mount Gerizim. It becomes a place for idols. The very place where Abraham stood where God said the whole world's going to be blessed by your seed. The very place where Jacob made a well. It had become a den of thieves. It had become a home of idols. It had become a home for ignorant pagans. The failures of Israel and the many accompanying renewals at Shechem, I think they prefigure the spiritual condition of Jesus' own time, and even ours a little bit also. Similarly, the woman's repeated marital failures are symbolic of everybody's need to commit to God once and for all. In the same way that Shechem represented broken marriages with God, broken promises, broken covenants, I think it's very interesting that the woman at the well also has her own long, sad history of broken covenants, broken promises, broken marriages. It's not accidental that Jesus talks to this woman. So Jesus reaches out to a woman who currently has no husband and has tried many in the past. Whether you're Israelite, Samaritan, or Gentile, you're really no different than the Samaritan woman at the well. We all come to God, as Romans 3, verse 23, as broken figures, fallen short of His glory because of the sins in our lives. We all come to God as the Samaritan woman at the well who says, I have no husband. I have no husband. Your Maker is your husband. Your God is your spouse. And He reaches out to us all now. Unfortunately, we're running short on time. I'm going to go ahead and save the second half of this lesson for another occasion when we have a little bit more time to look at some of the upcoming details in John 4 a little bit more closely. But if you wouldn't mind, log away some of this information from the city of Shechem. I would assert once again that Jesus never did anything by accident. I think everything that He did in His life was very intentional. And when you start looking at the history behind it, some of the context, the woman at the well says, our fathers worshipped on this mountain. Now you've seen photographs. You've seen Mount Gerizim. You can picture in your own mind the actual mountain where they would have been sitting here drinking at the well, the mountain in the background, and sure, pointing at it saying, our fathers worshipped at that very mountain. No, Jesus says, that's true. And the Jews worship in the Jerusalem temple. That's true. But there will come a time when the true worshipers will worship in spirit and truth. And that's who God is seeking right now. He's not seeking the pagans. He's not seeking the empty religion. He's not seeking ignorance. He's seeking those who want to be true worshipers of His, who want to be His spiritual bride, to be adopted by Him into His family. If you're not a Christian here this evening, you really ought to be. The woman at the well had a very specific need, and it was that she needed to hear the gospel. She met the Savior face to face. And even though we don't have the same privilege of face to face contact with Christ, He is nevertheless reaching out to every one of us, knocking on the door, like Revelation chapter 3 says, hoping, wishing, pleading with us to come to Him. So whatever need you might have, please come forward as we stand and sing.